Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Beam me up on the mamas of all mama shit.
Hey, I'm looking through my telescope and I see a mothership. Is that you? Beam me up.
Hey, DA, I'm thirsty, man. Could you beam me up for a cold one?
Hey, DA, what's going on, baby? Stop me off and beam me up.
DA, what's the dealio? Permission to get in that mothership.
Is my window seat still available? Beam me up.
What's going on, DA? Hey, man, I need you to do me a huge favor. My coworker's a jerk. Oh, just beam me up, man.
Get beamed up. Everyone else has. It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
And we come to you live for the Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans Studio. Rocket Mortgage with you every step of the way to provide a seamless mortgage experience. Glad you're with us. DA with you here on CBS Sports Radio. Coming up this hour, a former Minnesota Golden Gopher head coach takes a shot of the current Minnesota Golden Gophers head football coach, P.J. Fleck, saying he's got too big of an ego to succeed there. Also, we'll have New York Times bestselling author Jeff Perlman join us. He had been scheduled to join us last week, but had to reschedule for today. He wrote the wonderful book about the USFL Football for a Buck. We had him on a couple of months ago talking about that book. And because he's got such an intimate knowledge of what works and what doesn't in spring football, we will ask him about the Alliance and what he has seen over the first 2 weeks, and also his thoughts on the XFL coming in a year from now, and after that, supposedly, the Ricky Williams League. So there's going to be a lot of options out there if all these things come through for spring football. Can they all work? I doubt it. Some, though, can. As always, you can hit us up on the phones at 855-212-4227. That toll-free line brought to you by Geico. Great news. Quick way you could save money switching to Geico. Go to geico.com. 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. We knew that something was weird. Something was up. Something was fugazi when it came to Todd Gurley's health status. Todd Gurley was benched quickly in the NFC Championship game. Todd Gurley in the Super Bowl did not get nearly enough touches. Todd Gurley was consistently benched in favor of C.J. Anderson. And while C.J. Anderson was fine and they made it to the Super Bowl, let's face it, the Rams probably didn't belong there if the officials had simply done their job right anyway. And then we get to the Super Bowl 2 weeks later, and Gurley clearly still isn't the same. Sean McVay kept saying he's healthy, he's fine. Gurley said he's healthy, he's fine. Sean McVay said the only reason that he didn't get more touches in the Super Bowl was that because they weren't in any type of rhythm, and that McVay put the blame on himself for poor play calling. But, bum, 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 we have a twist to the story. C.J. Anderson joined FS1 yesterday, and Anderson said, quote, TJ was more hurt than what we thought. The injury was a little bit more than what everybody in the building thought, including himself. Yeah, we never really would tell. He never really could tell me. It was tough. I would say it was a sprained knee. Obviously, it's the same knee injury he's had before in his career. Obviously, I had surgery on my meniscus, and once you have a knee, you always have a knee. So it aggravates, and if he was getting a lot of touches earlier in the year, obviously, him being one of the best running backs, that probably was the case, end of quote. So here's C.J. Anderson saying, yeah, he was banged up, he was injured, and maybe even more injured than even he thought. Which makes total sense, because Todd Gurley is one of the most productive running backs in the NFL. Todd Gurley is in his physical prime, and Todd Gurley is the highest paid offensive weapon on the Los Angeles Rams. To not use him in a Super Bowl where the game is a one-score or two-score game throughout, in a game where you've only mustered a field goal, it didn't make any sense. And I will go to my grave absolutely crucifying Sean McVay, the supposed offensive mastermind, for ridiculously conservative and unimaginative play calling. Had Sean Payton been in that spot in the Super Bowl, Sean Payton, seeing his quarterback be a puddle, knowing his running back was banged up, seeing the Patriots with a very successful scheme against him, would have said, okay, let's go for it on fourth down. Okay, onside kick here. Okay, fake punt here. Okay, double reverse. All right, the Philly special. He would have tried something to jumpstart the offense and to get yards with a gadget play. And McVay never did it because McVay was too scared to make the first mistake in that game. McVay's inexperience shone through in the way he called that game. It was burned into his mind. Don't make the mistake. The Patriots don't beat themselves. Don't beat yourself. And he became paralyzed by the fear of making a mistake. And so it was incredibly conservative game plan. A conservative game call. An incredibly conservative approach the entire night. And every NFL person that keeps shoving down my throat the narrative that it was a great defensive effort, get lost. I've seen great defense. I know great defense. You, sir, were not great defense. Did Belichick and Brian Flores have a very good scheme? Yes. But was it incredible defense? Jared Goff looked like a JV quarterback. The play calling was happy to be three and out and punt. Three and out and punt. Three and out and punt. Todd Gurley was injured. And C.J. Anderson is C.J. Anderson. Cut by two teams last year. Stop it with the great defense. Brady didn't have a great game. Gronk is at the end of the line. The only guy that was open the entire night was Julian Edelman. Both quarterbacks played poorly for the most part, except Brady made one or two great throws. And the play calling was conservative to not make a mistake. That's not great defense. I say this because Sean McVay should have just admitted Todd Gurley was injured. Because without it, it makes no sense that he would have called it the way that it was. And with Gurley being injured, he still should have tried more gizmo gadget plays to open up some play, to open up some field, to open up some points. The only reason I can think why the Rams are still lying about Todd Gurley's health is for a strategy. Is that going into the NFC Championship game, they did not want to admit that Gurley was banged up. And going into the Super Bowl, they wanted the Patriots to have to try to game plan for Gurley. That's the only way this makes sense. And because they essentially lied that Gurley was injured, they never reported it, they had to follow through with the lie. I think that's the only way that it makes sense. That going into the Super Bowl, they didn't want to tip their hand that Gurley was injured so that Belichick would have to try to game plan for him. And then once they played the game and had not reported an injury, couldn't back off on the lie. And that's why Gurley kept saying, I'm healthy, I'm fine. That's why the team kept saying he was healthy and fine. And that's why after the Super Bowl and the exit interview, Todd Gurley didn't answer any questions because he couldn't tell the lie anymore. Because here it was, the season was over. He had 24 hours to digest not being used in the Super Bowl and had to continually suggest and lie that he was perfectly healthy and he wasn't. And here is C.J. Anderson 3 weeks later saying, yeah, he was injured. Yeah. Same knee he got injured in college. It was aggravated. And it hurt him. Okay, that makes sense. Not using Todd Gurley in the Super Bowl and the NFC Championship game doesn't make sense. I'll follow the make sense explanation here. 855-212-4CBS. 855-212-4227. Hit us on Twitter as well, DA on CBS. Joe tweets, thank you for giving me the best laugh of the week with the Yankees kid. Are we entirely sure this isn't a Mraz relative, a nephew maybe? This is incredible. Hashtag, it doesn't happen. Whereas you do have family down in Florida, and they are Yankee fans.
Correct. None of those are the family members I could vouch. I looked, and I was wondering myself.
You were wondering.
Yeah, I mean, my cousins now have kids that are getting a little older, but no, none of them shouting out anti-Machado stuff.
I have to say, I am so impressed that an 8-year-old has takes. And I certainly was a sports fan at 8, but I didn't have takes. I mean, that's something that you usually grow into, I think. This kid is a prodigy. He's already got takes.
I hate to take bows. I had takes at 8.
You had takes at 8.
You could ask Bob the Deli Man. I had a lot of takes.
What takes?
I wanted Chris Callaway cut the moment he fumbled that 97 onside kick. I was not a fan of Jimmy Key at all. I wanted him to get out, even though he was awesome, apparently, in hindsight, looking back. I used to spew takes sitting there, 8 years old, 9 years old, didn't matter. I had takes, baby.
You had 8-year-old, 9-year-old Mraz takes.
Yes. Didn't want Mariano Duncan to leave at second base. Had to stay there. I didn't want Chuck Knobloch.
And you would rant like this kid?
Yeah, complain to my dad or my dad's friends. They used to think it was a rip.
There is a real scary similarity between those two.
If I could tell this kid anything at all, one piece of advice, don't fall in love with cookies in the cafeteria.
That's really where your life started to go sideways.
I was thin at one point, soccer player even. Then it all turned around about that kid's age, by the way. I bellowed out, and I've been chasing ever since.
Uh-huh. It just doesn't happen. Fix tweets, every time Mraz has another Giants or Yankees meltdown, I just want that kid's voice going on behind him over and over. Hashtag, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't. Joe tweets, I'm convinced Yankees kid is just a recording of Mraz's voice sped up.
I don't want Bogarts. I don't want Betts. I don't want Donaldson. I don't want any of those guys.
Whose fault is that?
I don't want Paul Molitor.
But like Donaldson, he's barely a Blue Jay. They just signed Tulowitzki from the Blue Jays.
I don't want Pat Hanke. I don't want any of these guys in the AL East.
I don't want Bogarts. I don't want Betts. I don't want Donaldson. I don't want any of those guys.
I don't want Roger Clemens. I don't care if he comes here, wins World Series, and Cy Youngs. He's sticking something in his butt. I don't want him.
You're not going to take a guy you hate from another team.
Hey, Brett.
It's kind of like taking Tom Brady from the Patriots and adding him to the Dolphins. It just doesn't happen.
That's the flat line. It just doesn't happen. Maybe this is why I don't think we've seen as a Hall of Famer. Came from the Orioles.
Hey, Brett.
I don't want J.P. Loshman. I don't want him anywhere near the AFC East, okay?
Oh my God.
I don't want Cornelius Bennett.
Cornelius Bennett.
I don't want Joe Klecko. I don't want AJ Dewey. I don't want any of those guys anywhere near the AFC East. Get them out.
It just doesn't happen.
It just doesn't happen. Senor Pantleg tweets, my favorite part of that clip is the New York cameraman screaming, why not, to the little kid. Yeah, the little kid. Cameraman's like, Machado, $300 million, expecting all of the adults to be like, boo, boo. And suddenly the kid launches you, we didn't want him anyway.
Manny Machado just signed a $300 million deal with the Padres.
I don't want Machado on the Yankees.
Why not?
Hey, why not, kid? Let's stoke more New York anger. One day you'll be flipping off people in traffic. One day you'll be cursing at everybody on the subway. You're mad. Start it now.
Why not?
Why not? I don't want Leroy Horde. I don't want Ernest Miner. I don't want Eric Metcalf. Nobody in the AFC North.
It just doesn't happen.
Why not?
I don't want Neil O'Donnell. I don't want Vinny Testaverde. I don't want Boomer Esiason. It just doesn't happen.
I don't want any of those guys.
Ah,
why not?
Why not?
That kid is amazing. Absolutely amazing. When we come back here on the show, is there too much ego with Minnesota Golden Gophers head coach P.J. Fleck? At one point, he was the hottest commodity in college football coaching, and now a former Minnesota coach is taking his shots at P.J. Story next, D.A., CBS Sports Radio.
We are the glitch in the simulation.
You're listening to the D.A. Show. Boom shakalaka.
D.A. on CBS Sports Radio.
It's past the hour. DA with you here on CBS Sports Radio. You can listen to us across the great CBS Sports Radio Network and also on Sirius XM Channel 206. That's Sirius XM Channel 206. Coming up, Jeff Perlman's going to join us, New York Times bestselling author. He wrote the book on the USFL, and so he knows everything about a spring football league success and failure. We shall discuss what he is observed in the Alliance over the first 2 weeks, plus the big news yesterday, which we should clarify because it began to become clearer over the course of the day. You had the report surface in the morning that the Alliance was unable to pay its players after week two. And that this had scared a bunch of the people in the AAF. This was from a story reported in The Athletic. The Alliance claimed it was just a computer glitch. And then there was a story that surfaced that they had changed payroll providers or payroll servers. And so there was a technical glitch and a delay in getting paid. Which, let's face it, either way, if they had the money and it was a glitch, or didn't have the money, that's a bad look in week number two of a brand new football league because it's only week two. You should be able to figure out your payroll stuff like in the off season or wait for changing a payroll server until later on in the season. Let things go smoothly now. But then to counteract the story seemingly in real time, the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes invested $250 million, which again didn't necessarily seem like it coincided with the payroll story because payroll for the entire year is $32 million for the entire league. There's eight teams, 50 players per team, and they could only make $80,000 a season. So it didn't make any sense that there's $250 million coming in to cover payroll. That's payroll for a decade. The story clarified that the league had a lot of startup cost, obviously, and was always looking for investors or an investor. And that perhaps it was to announce that they are financially solvent in the wake of the story, or perhaps this guy was already ready to invest and then just said, okay, well, I can do it right now because he really was impressed over the first 2 weeks. But that they wanted one big whale. They wanted one big influx of money. And they got it, $250 million in one fell swoop from this dude who's now going to be the chair of the league. That they were looking for this all along, had been talking to investors all along. Probably these investors wanted proof of concept. And this guy saw the first 2 weeks and said, I got my proof, I'm in. Now, maybe they said, let's announce it now in the wake of this story about payroll. But either way, I think it's safe to say, Meraz, Alliance primetime is here to stay because with $250 million now in their coffers, we get at least the rest of the season, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I actually read another breakdown yesterday where I believe it was something to the extent of after 3 years of simply player payroll. Now, this doesn't take into account executives and coaches. It would cost the league, I think, somewhere around $90 million. Now, that number could be a little off.
3 years?
3 years total.
To run the entire league is 90 mil.
Yes, to run the entire 90 mil. So if it's 250 mil invested, now you factor this different PR, all this other stuff that adds up. My assumption is, and I think a lot of people close to the league, and this really should be for you on Alliance Primetime Monday, is that forget through this year, the 250 mil actually secures 3 years of Alliance football.
That's what I would say. I would say that if payroll for every player in the league is going to be about $35 million, let's just say $35 million per season, over the course of 3 years, that's about $100 million or so. With executives, staffing, coaching, leases on stadiums, merchandise stuff, all the little things that go into running a league.
Sissies, gift cards.
Right. I would imagine that $250 million keep the league afloat minimum, all told, for four seasons.
Now, let me ask you something. Do you think beyond three seasons with this investment, I thought about this a lot because I have a lot of Alliance takes.
Sure.
Is it the NFL's duty now to jump in with money and invest as well?
If,
you don't think so?
It's not the NFL's duty. I mean, I think the NFL takes a wait-and-see approach and sees if this thing can work, if they can run themselves, because you don't want to throw money after bad money. You don't want to try to sink. You don't want to try to float a sinking boat. But I think that the NFL will. I think the NFL is absolutely going to invest, but I don't think it's their responsibility.
Yeah, but this gives them that platform like we're seeing in spring training with baseball with the pitch clocks or stuff in minor leagues in baseball. All the rules, instead of just throwing stuff against the wall, they could always run by if they get their stock in this in the spring league and see how things are working.
It's a brilliant move if the NFL has the Alliance as their feeder system. It's brilliant. It works on every single level. You can develop players, you can develop coaches, you can develop rules, you can institute new rules changes. You can do everything that you want to do. Plus, you get everybody talking football, wanting football for a full calendar year, watching games on your network. It makes all the sense of the world. I can't say the NFL has to do that. I think eventually they will, but it's not their responsibility necessarily.
Yeah, just me with greed as a football fan wanting them to be responsible.
I think they will. I think that this league has more leash for the NFL to jump in, more likelihood than the XFL or Ricky Williams League, that's for sure. So PJ Fleck used to be, a couple of years ago, the hottest name, the hottest commodity in college coaching. And his ascent up the ranks was very obvious. He had these catchphrases, row the boat. He seemed to be recruiting really well to smaller schools, directional schools, in the MAC, and everybody said he's the next big college football coach that you want to land. And then he took the Minnesota job. I think some people were kind of surprised that he wouldn't have waited for a more elite or premier job. Not that Minnesota is a terrible job, but a lot of people around college football, I think, said, wow, you're going to jump to Minnesota right now. And so far, it's been okay. It hasn't been great. He is certainly a great quote. He's a good soundbite. He's a good interview. He's a good marketer. He has those socks, and he has his row the boat, and he's young, and he seems innovative. And so all of these things make you feel as though, and he had success in his stop before, so it makes you feel as though, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. Except at this point in time, P.J. Fleck in 2 years of Minnesota is sub-500. He's 12-13. Now, last year, he did beat Wisconsin. That was big, although Wisconsin was down last year. We were surprised that Wisconsin was not a more powerful foe and also beat Georgia Tech in their bowl game. But here's Jerry Kill, who was his head coach when PJ was an assistant coach at Northern Illinois. PJ Fleck was an assistant coach under Kill in 09 and 10. And that Jerry Kill helped Fleck land the Western Michigan job 5 years ago. And he went off on PJ Fleck. Quote, sometimes ego gets carried away, he told SiriusXM College's Big Ten Today. When he went to Minnesota and treated people the way that he treated my guys, telling them he had to go in and completely change the culture, that it was a bad culture, bad people, he made it sound like we didn't know what we were doing. I took it personal. You just don't treat people who have helped your career, and you don't even talk to them once after you get the job. Talking about himself, apparently PJ did not reach out to Jerry Kill after Kill helped him get the job. It's not good. Do I still root for the Gophers? I do. Do I enjoy him running up and down the sidelines? No. Do I think he's about the players? No. He's about himself. This is really interesting because you never hear coaches in the coaching fraternity go after one another, let alone a guy go after his former assistant coach at the place that he used to be a head coach. Now, Kill might not be happy with the way things ended for him. He might not be happy with the way things happened for his successor, Tracy Clays. But there's some animosity there. And I think that PJ Fleck has got to win pretty big pretty quickly because he does have an ego. And people are shooting for him because he comes off as the smartest guy in the room. And he's got all these hokey catchphrases that when he's winning, it seems like they work. And when he's losing, seems like they're just marketing and that he's artificial and there's nothing there. And I think there's some resentment built around PJ Fleck for his ascent. And I can certainly see that Kill does not trust him and that I absolutely believe that he's got a big ego. PJ Fleck's got a huge ego. But you know what? It doesn't really matter if you win. And so if you lose, you can take pot shots. If you win, nobody can do that to you. Fleck's going to have to win or else there's going to be more people that speak out like this. When we come back, Jeff Perlman, New York Times bestselling author, DA, CBS Sports Radio.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
A no sweatpants at work zone.
The reason I've listened since overnight is you and Mraz bring the insight. You bring the honesty. You bring the stuff we want to hear. It is the cheese talk.
It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
The cheese talk. It's why we're here.
You need to eat like this. You need to eat like this.
Thanks for being with us. You can watch the show on any device. Check out the simulcast at watchda.com. That's also mobile friendly. Join CBS on the road to the Final Four with the great NCAA basketball this weekend. Saturday at 1:30 Eastern, 10:30 Pacific, Auburn heads to Lexington to take on fourth-ranked Kentucky, followed by number 16 Florida State against eighth-ranked UNC in Chapel Hill. Then on Sunday, Villanova tips off against Xavier at 1:30 Eastern, 10:30 Pacific, and the weekend concludes when seventh-ranked Michigan hosts number 10 Michigan State. Madness is in the air!
CBS is spectacular, yeah!
Other madness in the air, spring football. And our next guest is all things authority on spring football. He wrote the dominant book of the USFL called Football for a Buck. We had him on a couple of months ago to discuss that amazing book. He's a New York Times best-selling author and also working on a new book about the Lakers of Shaq and Kobe era, Jeff Perlman. Jeff, good morning. How are we doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you.
Always good to have you here on the show. And yesterday there was kind of big AAF news because we had the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes infusing $250 million worth of cash into this league. Were you surprised at that news? What was your reaction after doing all of the research you did about the USFL?
My reaction was, this is not a good sign at all. And I was actually really disappointed to hear that because it's a terrible, terrible sign for that league that they already are in sort of financial peril and had to take that step. And there are a lot of echoes. I mean, I've been getting a lot of calls this week, the USFL, can you compare? And I didn't think there were that many really great comparisons, but this is the first one where you're like, oh, that's a really bad sign about a league that needs financial help this early.
What now, the $250 million should be able to keep a league afloat for a really long time, but what is it about this announcement at this time that makes you feel like, oh, this is a really bad sign?
Well, I mean, it means that they didn't really do their financial planning wasn't very good. I mean, the thing that I really liked about this league and what sort of seemed very encouraging was centralized ownership, the league control, not going after big-name superstars, so everything was affordable. And so to take this step, it just really screams that their financial planning isn't quite what it seems and that they don't quite know what they were doing. So it's to me, it's very discouraging. It really is. I'm not just saying that. I want this league to succeed. I love new leagues. But it's really, really a bad sign early on that they have to take this step. Like, really a bad sign.
because at the heart of the USFL's demise was owners in competition with other owners, right? With a centralized league, it kind of takes that part out of it, so that makes this somewhat safer?
Well, you would think so, because you're not going to have bidding wars, right? You're not going to have bidding wars. You're not going to have a Donald Trump or a Bill Oldenburg come along and blow up the spending scale, and that's a good thing. You know, the USFL, one of the big things that happened early on, back in the first season, the 83 season, is the owner of the Michigan Panthers decided, we really want to win, so we're going to spend millions on three offensive linemen. And as soon as they did that, everybody started spending on everything. If you're going to spend an offensive lineman, I'm going to get that halfback. If you're going to get that halfback, I'm going to get that quarterback. So I thought the really good thing about the alliance is you're not going to have that issue, and that takes care of a lot of the financial problems, because the competitiveness won't be there. So again, to see this, I don't know how it reached that point that quickly. But and the other thing that really concerns me is the attendance figures. The attendance figures are not great, and you look at the stadiums, and they do look really small, and the ticket prices are way too high for a new league. That's another thing I do not understand at all. The price of tickets is way too high.
Jeff Perlman joins us this morning here on the show, because one of the things about the USFL, as you researched and experienced and remember, was that early attendance figures for most of the USFL was really, really good, right?
Yeah, they did. They drew well. And, I mean, certain markets didn't. Washington was a disaster. But they drew well because the one thing they actually had, they had some names. You know, they had Herschel Walker. So you knew when Herschel Walker was coming to town, you're going to go see Herschel Walker. They had a lot of sort of big, you know, like, this sounds quaint in hindsight. You know, Chuck Fusina was a quarterback of the Philadelphia Stars. Well, Chuck Fusina, a couple years earlier, was a runner-up in the Heisman Trophy voting at Penn State. He was a big regional name. So they were able to pull off of that. And I don't think the Alliance has some interesting names, but I don't think Trent Richardson is necessarily going to draw you fans in and of himself. I don't think Kristen Hackenberg is going to draw fans in and of himself. I want this league to succeed really well, but you can't charge this much for tickets early on. You have to draw people in with promotions, with affordable tickets, and hope they like the product. So I'm a little, there's some things I don't like what I see.
Skeptics would say that maybe we don't have the appetite for football year-round because the NFL is kind of year-round. We're into the scouting combine now and then the NFL draft and free agency. Do you think there's an appetite around the country to watch live football in the spring?
I think there could be. I mean, I really think markets, you know, I always say location, location, location. Like, I don't understand having teams in Atlanta. I don't understand the team in Arizona. I think, you know, putting teams in cities, sort of Birmingham, Orlando, places like Boise, I'm just throwing out cities, you know, Memphis, that makes sense where they don't have NFL teams and you can get that sort of almost NFL experience and you can take your kid to a game. I think that makes sense. But certainly in NFL cities, I can't imagine as much of a need for more football when you already have a team and an established team. That was another, I'm not trying to sell a book here, I swear. That was another lesson of the USFL, that generally the markets with NFL franchises did not do nearly as well as the markets where there was no team before.
Well, maybe just because I just read your book a couple of months ago and we had you on to talk about it, but every time I sit down to watch the Alliance, and I've watched a bunch of games already, I can't help but think about your book, and I can't help but think about the USFL. There feels like there's a lot of correlations and a lot of similarities and a lot of lessons to be learned, but when you look at the league, do you see similarities or a lot of differences?
See, I see a lot of similarities in the regional, trying to have regional players on the teams. Playing in a different season, I see those. The funky uniforms are kind of neat. But again, the centralized ownership was the one that I was like, yeah, there's something learned. There's a really good lesson learned right there, not having the owners spending against each other all the time. And then when I saw they needed that much money, I thought, oh, crap, it kind of is like the USFL. Because the USFL was hemorrhaging money from the very beginning. I mean, the World Football League in the 70s, same problem. That you're going to lose money at the beginning. And it felt like they had a sort of way of not having that as such a big problem. And now I'm not so sure.
One of the coolest things I think about when you work on books is that you take a lot of your followers and readers behind the process of making those books and of writing those books and stories behind tracking down interviews. You've been pretty transparent about tracking down interviews with this Shaq, Kobe, Showtime Lakers of the late 90s, early 2000s run. How has it been trying to put together the anecdotes of that era?
Oh, it's been fun, really fun. I just a couple weeks ago, so every now and then I'll get an address, and I don't have a phone number. I'll just find an address, and I'll just show up at someone's house. And 2000-2001 season, the Lakers had J.R. Ryder for a year. And all I had was an address in Arizona, and it was going to be out in Phoenix anyway. So I knocked on his door randomly with a book and a note. And usually if someone's not there, I'll just leave the book and the note. But a kid answers the door, then a woman comes to the door, and then JR comes to the door. And he's like, who are you? What are you doing here? You know, it was kind of awkward. And that comes with knocking on a guy's door at 9 in the morning randomly. What are you doing here? And I'm like, wow, I wrote this book, and I had my USFL book. I did this book, and blah, blah, blah. He's like, man, bro, you can't just show up at someone's door. Bro, you can't just... what's the book about? Well, it's about the Lakers. Oh, so like Shaq, Kobe? Yeah. He's like, all right, man, I have a good feel for you. And we ended up talking for an hour and a half, and he was awesome. So, you know, I love the hunt of finding guys and tracking down. It's one of the joys of the profession.
They win three straight titles, but everybody always knows they could have won more. Now that we're about... I guess 15 years or so removed from the end of that. Do you feel like there's a lot of remorse between Shaq, Kobe, and everybody else that they did not keep that together because of ego?
No, I think maybe from the supporting cast, the Rick Fox and Robert Ory's and those guys. I think Kobe enjoyed his career far more when Shaq was gone, and I think Shaq enjoyed. I think if anything, Shaq would say, "I should have stayed in Orlando." That with that base of Penny Hardaway and Nick Anderson and Dennis Scott, we could have won five or six titles, and that was probably the more talented team if you actually look at the roster than the Laker team he was on. So I actually think if anything, I don't think he delves in regret even remotely, but I think he would say I could have won the most staying in Orlando.
What's the big surprise for you as you've researched and talked to people in this book? Something that really kind of you were taken aback by about that era.
I mean. I'll tell you one thing. It's not a huge surprise, but I really do believe, and I've thought about it so much. So when Shaq and Kobe arrived, that team was a Nick Van Exel, Eddie Jones, Cedric Ceballos, Eldon Campbell. They were a far more talented team with Del Harris as their coach. Like a far more talented team. If you look at that team, and in his prime, Nick Van Exel, and in his prime, Cedric Ceballos, and coming into his prime, Eddie Jones, they were really, really loaded. But they were just painfully immature. I'm actually really fascinated by the Del Harris years of that team. Like, I love the minutia of those sort of things and just how good they really could have been. And people forget how good they actually were. They weren't championship caliber. But they were really close. And there's this whole what if they had kept that core together. You know, I sat down for 10 hours with Del Harris in Texas. And, you know, I think he really believes, and maybe rightly so, that they could have won championships if they just left that thing intact. But they didn't.
Huh. When does that book come out?
That comes out in spring of 2020, so about a year from now.
One day, do you think you'll be writing about the LeBron Lakers?
I don't know. They're probably not even going to make the playoffs this year, so I don't know how fondly people will have to see how it turns out.
Jeff Perlman joining us this morning on the show. Jeff, it's always good to catch up, my man. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks for having me.
You got it. Jeff Perlman joining us. Here on the DA Show on CBS Sports Radio, and our toll-free line is brought to you by GEICO. Everyone, there's a quick way you could save money switching to GEICO. Need homeowners, renters, motorcycle insurance, too? Get it all at GEICO.com. It's so funny because I like the Alliance. Mraz loves the Alliance. I like the Alliance, but I've got a healthy dose of reality. Mraz protects the Alliance. Mraz is protective of this thing. It's like a little hatchling that he's trying to incubate and make sure that it stays healthy. And I just know when Jeff Perlman's like, this is a really bad sign. The $250 million was a really bad sign. This league could be in peril. I just know it was sinking the heart of Mraz to hear that in these airwaves.
It's too negative. Again, this is healthy now for three. We got 3 years of spring football. Let's see. I'm asking you if it's the NFL's duty to help the league.
I know when you heard Perlman say that, you were like crestfallen.
I just rolled my eyes. I do think there's an element to people, for whatever reason, like wear it as a badge of honor to point out why the league's going to fail instead of embracing why it could succeed.
Well, we live in a day and age where cynicism sells, and to be snarky and to be detached emotionally and not to be supportive of things is cool. And we do this on social media all the time. I'm certainly guilty of this as well on this show and on social media. So expecting a startup league to fail and then kind of snarkily expecting it and calling for it and almost rooting for it is kind of, it's par for the course for today's day and age. But I think this league is actually fine because I think this league fits perfectly into the NFL's investment portfolio. They're not trying in any way to poach players from the NFL. They're not trying to be a competitor to the NFL. They're trying to be a minor league of the NFL. They're actively trying to be a support arm, which is so different from other spring leagues and other football leagues. So in that way, ultimately, it's going to be fine because I think the NFL is going to see, yeah, good investment opportunity. And once that happens, it ain't going away. The NFL kept NFL Europe afloat for probably 6 years longer than it ever should have been. And that was in Europe. When we come back here on the show, does the Manny Machado signing show that calls of collusion in baseball were false?
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.